With Argento, it's debatable how much story he actually needs as connecting tissue between his scenes of exquisite mayhem. Kim Newman. Hi, this is Carla, and welcome back to There Might Be Cupcakes. This is episode 53, Exquisite Mayhem, the second episode in what turns out will be, appropriately enough in more ways than one, the second of third in the Three Mothers horror movie trilogy. This episode is mainly focusing on the Luca, I'm not Italian, so please forgive me, Guadagnino, 2018 remake of Suspiria. I will review its plot in detail, which is a thing I don't normally do, and I feel I need to in order to be able to refer to details without completely confusing you. So, huge spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it and do want to. You might want to save this episode until you watch the remake, because for once, I'm going to go for it. Deep dive. Okay, last warning. And here we go. An elderly psychiatrist gentleman is visited by a young woman, Patricia Hingle, who is claiming that her dance teachers are witches. She says at first that she gave into their wiles because she gained things in return. But then, she claims, these dance teachers took her hair and her urine, and her eyes, which is not true. She still has her eyes. And now they can see her. They can see what she can see. She catches a glimpse of the psychiatrist's Freemasonry handbook with the all-seeing eye on the cover, panics anew, and runs from his office, leaving behind her journal. The psychiatrist later looks at her journal to see all of her musings and later ramblings about her dance teachers being witches. Meanwhile, Susie Banyan, an Amish girl, arrives afresh at the same dance school to audition. She's accepted extremely quickly without any formal dance training and without any resume, and the dance academy further offers to pay for her stay at the school. It seems too good to be true. Susie meets her new roommate, Sarah, who informs her that her earlier roommate, Patricia, is missing. Rumors have abounded that Patricia might be involved in 1977 Germany's politics, that she might be a radical involved in local bombings, so she's run away to participate. Sarah's worried and gets Susie to help her look around. They find that Patricia's dance school records are missing. This dance company is going to perform Volk, an incredibly demanding modern dance made famous by the head teacher, Madame Blanc. The dance company was going to perform Volk, an incredibly demanding modern dance made famous by the head teacher, Madame Blanc. Patricia was supposed to dance the role of the protagonist. Susie blurts out that she can dance this complicated role because she has watched the documentary on this piece and studied it. Before she can demonstrate this, Olga, another dancer, yells at the teacher about how they have no concern for Patricia's whereabouts, and when one of them again repeats the story of Patricia's becoming a German radical, Olga announces she is leaving. Her parting words are to call the teachers witches. As Susie prepares to dance the role of protagonist in Volk, to demonstrate that she can, and Olga is leaving, one of the teachers passes Olga on the stairs, and Olga suddenly cannot see. Olga, her eyes watering, stumbles into a practice room that is completely mirrored. Madame Blanc passes her hand over Susie's back, and Susie begins to dance, forcing Olga to dance with her in one of the most ghastly and yet most beautifully executed sequences of body horror that I have ever seen. Susie begins to have nightmares of Madame Blanc, of her own sick and abusive slash overly punitive mother, of images of body horror. She draws closer and closer to Madame Blanc as the teachers discuss if Susie is the correct one for the mysterious head of their coven, Mother Marcos, noting that they pushed Patricia too soon and too hard. It is now time to perform Volk for an audience, for the last time ever, Madame Blanc announces. The teachers lie down a complicated series of interlocked pentagrams on the performance stage using metal strips, upon which the girls will dance. The design mimics one in Patricia's journal. Sarah, meanwhile, in a scene reminiscent of one in the original movie, has found the secret all-mirrored room where Olga died, and found a hidden doorway within it which leads to tunnels beneath the school. There she finds a mangled Olga and an undead Patricia, also other half-dead and undead dancers, including ones whose organs of dance expression, her hands and feet, have been removed. Sarah runs, getting lost, and a hole opens up before her. She steps into it and breaks her leg. In another a scene of body horror. Several teachers appear and force her leg back into place using magic and do something unspecified to her mind, also forcing her back to the stage against her will, where she joins the bizarre, aggressive, grunting dance already in progress. The dancers are wearing red costumes, the tops of which look like pentagrams across their breast, the bottoms of which look like they are bleeding off their bodies. Near the end, Sarah has a screaming fit, her leg breaking anew, and the famous last performance is never completed. The psychiatrist, Dr. Joseph Klimperer, meanwhile, has been traveling back and forth between East and West Berlin, which is a laborious process, to visit his vacation home, which was once his home with his wife Anka. Anka disappeared during World War II, and her disappearance mirrors itself in Patricia's. Patricia's haunts him because of Anka's. During one of these visits, Anka steps out of the front door of the vacation home. They happily reunite, and Anka and Joseph slowly stroll back through the East Berlin-West Berlin checkpoint and continue walking, as she explains that she lost him through detainment during the war. She did not have her appropriate papers. She was unable to prove her identity. Walking arm in arm, they find themselves in front of the Marcos School of Dance. Joseph, who had stepped a few paces ahead of Anka, recognizes it and turns to tell Anka of the strange goings-on surrounding his patient, Patricia. Anka is gone. There is nowhere for her to have vanished to, no alleyway, no side street. There is only snow and silence, until dance teachers come shrieking out of the dance school at him and drag him inside. This final scene is known as the Black Sabbath scene, to quote Vulture magazine. I'll link to the magazine review and their exploration of this scene and this episode's website entry in the show notes. I won't describe it here, it's too visual. Basically, Mother Marcos states her purpose to take over Susie's young body if Susie is a willing sacrifice. Susie asks Mother Marcos which of the three mothers she serves, darkness, tears, or sighs, Tenebrae, Lacrimarum, or Suspiriorum. Marcus hisses Suspiriorum, which is a departure from the original trilogy. In it, Mother Marcos was Mater Suspiriorum. And Susie smiles beatifically and says, I am her. And death itself comes from the depth of the school, wreaking havoc. Susie releases the three, Patricia, Olga, and Sarah, per their wishes, and lets them die. Sounds like a fairy tale, just like the original, doesn't it? Though a more linear fairy tale. All the elements are there. Secrets, identity, getting lost, getting lured, quest, false mothers, cruel mothers, even going to the ball, in a sense. Except in this fairy tale, there is no prince. The princess rescues, if it's fair to use that word, herself. I'll talk about this more when I return to Snow White, the original inspiration for Suspiria, and I discuss the version I read in that last episode and all its hidden oddities. But for now, I want to talk about identity in this remake and how it's almost a character all of its own. First, there's the metaphor of hijackers and political statement bombings that's woven in and out as a subplot. 1977 Berlin and 1977 in general was a fraught time and place. I remember as a child being aware of regular hijacking of planes and cruise ships, as well as bombings. The passenger next to you on your flight could suddenly stand up and take over, making demands and waving a weapon. Yes, almost 25 years before 9/11, this happened with regularity. And you know whether Underground is an app or a service that feeds you the weather. To me, that phrase means a militant group that developed from the activism of the 1960s, a group that believed that nonviolent protests were no longer effective. And these young people began bomb manufacturing, taking credit for bombing the New York City police station in 1970. That's what immediately came to my mind when the false accusations about Patricia's absences were planted, was the Weather Underground. What's being highlighted in the movie is the Red Army faction. They were a radical left group that terrorized West Germany with bombings, bank robberies, kidnappings, and assassinations over 30 years, starting at the beginning of World War II. Late 1977 was the worst time, which became known as the German Autumn, which included the hijacking of Lufthansa, like I said, Lufthansa Flight 181. I vaguely remember that. I was 77, I was 5. Again, your friend, your roommate in your dance company, your fellow dance teacher, could actually be a bomber to bank robber. Secret and dangerous second identities, which could include being a witch. You also see another disturbing metaphor for identification in the movie, the East Berlin / West Berlin gate and Dr. Klemperer's Aryan papers. One long shot shows the laborious process through which the doctor must go to pass from one side of Berlin to the other, proving his identity again and again, going through checkpoint after checkpoint and waiting in line after line. Watching the sequence was draining, and it was supposed to be. And then later we see a close-up of the doctor's Aryan papers. There's a pamphlet that looked much like a passport from the time of World War II that in detail showed his genealogy and demonstrated that he was white enough to receive the privileges thereunto. It was an eerie document, and it made the viewer more aware of the one woman of color amongst the dance instructors, and how her presence must have still been a radical act at that time, especially during the politically tumultuous and dangerous German autumn. And it made the viewer more aware that all of the dancers in the company are white. Racial identity at the time of the movie is still haunting Germany, even amongst those with so much power, like this coven. And then there, of course, there is playing a character in a dance. Not all dance, of course, is playing a character, but all of the dances taught to these students in the movie involve doing so. The lead in Volk was simply called the protagonist. Volk is German for people, or the nation, or the masses. So the protagonist would be the leader, which in the ending, we see Susie most certainly is. She is the mother. A spell that is seen in this movie, and in the original Suspiria's inspiration, Snow White, is the glamour. Y'all might remember it from the movie The Craft. It's a spell that allows the caster to alter their appearance. In Snow White, the stepmother uses it to approach Snow White the three times in order to entice her to harm. In this movie, the witches use it to pretend to be Dr. Klemperer's lost wife, Anka. And in Sleeping Beauty, which will come up in a moment, the wicked fairy Maleficent uses it, in some versions, to hide her identity in order to attend Princess Aurora's christening. The witches hide in plain sight as dance instructors, and they hide incantations within the dance they teach of their company. And there's another fun glamour happening in this movie. Tilda Swinton is hidden within this movie, creating yet another triad. This is so much fun. Tilda Swinton, of course, plays the striking and powerful dance instructor Madame Blanc. But she also played the decaying and grotesque Mother Marcos. And she played Dr. Joseph Klemperer, the only male in the film, besides the police officers, which are only briefly shown. Dr. Klemperer even has full frontal nude shots in the Black Sabbath denouement. I have seen people, including the Vulture magazine reviewer, claim that it was so obvious that the psychiatrist was Swinton that they could see that it was obviously Tilda Swinton with makeup. But I highly doubt their claims. The makeup and her performance were both incredibly skillful. Even upon my second viewing, when I knew it was her, I watched for tells, and I saw none. She looked, moved, and sounded like a man. Two more identities I've mentioned in this remake. Jessica Harper, the beautiful actress who played Susie Bannion in the original Suspiria, who was chosen by Dario Argento for her resemblance to Snow White. You can see her in my artwork for episode 51, Elegant Nastiness. Made a quiet cameo in this movie. She played Dr. Joseph Klemperer's missing wife, Anka. Malgosia Bella, also credited as Margozata Bella, played both Susie's dying and overly punitive mother, and Death herself, who emerges during the Black Sabbath finale once Susie meets Mother Marcos. I have mentioned dance as spell work in the spoilers more than once. The body as incantation and incantatory has been described in historical accounts of Sabbath, of witches dancing in the forest. Modern day practitioners of the craft often use their entire bodies in their practice and worship. Notice I speak as a geeky reader of comparative religion only. If anyone who practices wants to talk to me about this, I would be thrilled and honored. My email and Google Voice phone number are in the show notes and on the website. This is all echoed in the lyrics of the haunting soundtrack by Tom York of Radiohead. To quote from his song Superium, "This is what I was thinking about our bodies, what they mean for our salvation. Only the clothes that we stand up in, only the ground in which we stand, is the darkness ours to take, bathed in lightning, bathed in heat. All is well as long as we keep spinning, here now dancing behind the wall. Mother wants us right beside her. No tomorrows. Patricia tells her psychiatrist that the witches took her hair and her urine. We see Susie's gorgeous long red hair, which has ostensibly never been cut since she was Amish, chopped off supposedly for the roles of the protagonist in Volk. And we see one of the teachers sweep up and carry her hair off in the background. We also see Susie and the other students giving urine samples to one of the teachers. We assume that the teachers told them their health is being monitored. Across many cultures and times, there are beliefs that if someone possesses a part of your body, they can make things happen to you or for you. And then we come to sleep and dreams as spell work. The scientists continue to work on the mysteries of the dream world. I myself currently take an off-label medication to help with chronic nightmares brought on by chronic PTSD. As I've discussed in other episodes, sleep is one of the human activities about which we know the least. In the original Suspiria, Susie and the other dancers are drugged by their teachers in order to be controlled. It's never specified what they are given, but we are led to believe that it is as much spell work as normal pharmaceutical work. In the remake, the witch/teachers use direct spell work from their own rooms in order to induce sleep and nightmares. In both movies and these spell-induced dream states, Susie sees dancing lights in her room, flitting about her and her belongings. Is this the witch teacher searching what she owns and what she knows? Or merely Susie's third eye, her unknown talents, opening up under the spells? Or both? The liminal-luminal space between sleep and awakening is charged with power, it seems, with imagery and knowledge that the brain doesn't give us when we are awake. Identity comes to play in this as well. In the remake, Susie comes awake from a nightmare screaming, "I know who I am." Sleep paralysis is a horrifying experience that is, unfortunately, experienced by 7.6% of the American general population, according to a National Institute of Health study. In that same study, the scientists found that the subjects of this movie, college-age students, were 28.3% more likely to experience sleep paralysis than the average person. Psychiatric patients of that age, like Patricia, the first dance student we see in the remake, have an even higher likelihood of experiencing this horrifying sleep disruption, 31.9% and 34.6% for psychiatric patients with panic disorder, which appears to be what's wrong with Patricia, according to Dr. Klemperer's notes. This experience reportedly lasts from anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes and encompasses typical panic symptoms, difficulty breathing, overwhelming feelings of fear, racing heartbeat, pressure on the chest, along with the feeling of being trapped in bed, which includes complete body paralysis. People do report only being able to move their eyes, if that. In addition, 75% of the people who experience this terrifying sleep disorder report accompanying hallucinations, and 51 to 63%, depending upon the study, report seeing or feeling some sort of dark presence in the room with them or on the bed. In some cultures, this experience is known as being hag-ridden or being ridden by the witch, literally having a witch sitting on your chest while you sleep and riding like a horse. And that leads us to another fairy tale, a tale that is not only another Disney princess, but a modern archetype, for we know what it means when someone is affectionately called a sleeping beauty. Her original name, as you will hear, was Aurora, which means dawn, daybreak, sunrise, dating back to, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, late Middle English, referring back to the Latin Aurora, the Roman goddess of the dawn. So Princess Aurora slumbers for 100 years, but we know she will awaken, and when she does, it will be a new day, of some sort. Good or ill, the story will tell us. Charles Perrault. Source: The Fairy Tales of Charles Perrault. The Sleeping Beauty in the Wood. There were formerly a king and queen who were so very sorry they had no children, so sorry that it cannot be expressed. They went to all the waters in the world. Vows, pilgrimages, all ways were tried, and all to no purpose. At last, however, the queen proved with child, and was brought to bed of a daughter. There was a very fine christening, and the princess had for her godmothers all the fairies they could find in the whole kingdom. They found 7, that every one of them might give her a gift, as was the custom of fairies in those days, and by this means the princess might have all the perfections imaginable. After the ceremonies of the christening were over, all the company returned to the king's palace, where was prepared a great feast for the fairies. There was placed before every one of them a magnificent cover with a case of massive gold, wherein was a spoon, knife, and fork, all of pure gold set with diamonds and rubies. But as they were all sitting down at table, they saw come into the hall a very old fairy whom they had not invited, because it was above 50 years since she had been out of a certain tower, and she was believed to either be dead or enchanted. The king quickly ordered her a cover, but he could not furnish her with a case of gold as the others, because they had 7 only made for the 7 fairies. The old fairy fancied she was slighted, and muttered some threat between her teeth. One of the young fairies who sat by her overheard how she grumbled, and judging that she might give the princess some unlucky gift, went, as soon as she rose from the table, and hid herself behind the hangings, so that she might speak last and repair as much as she could the evil which the old fairy might intend. In the meanwhile, all the fairies began to give their gifts to the princess. The youngest gave her for gift that she should be the most beautiful person in the world. The next, that she should have the wit of an angel. The third, that she should have the wonderful grace in everything she did. The fourth, that she should dance perfectly well. The fifth, that she should sing like a nightingale. And the sixth, that she should play upon all kinds of music to the utmost perfection. The old fairy's turn coming next, with a head shaking more with spite than age, she said that the princess should have her hand pierced with a spindle and die of the wound. This terrible gift made the whole company tremble, and everybody fell a crying. At this very instant, the young fairy came out from behind the draperies and spake these words aloud. "Be reassured, O king and queen, your daughter shall not die of this disaster. It is true, I have no power to undo entirely what my elder has done. The princess shall indeed pierce her hand with a spindle, but instead of dying, she shall only fall into a profound sleep, which shall last 100 years, at the expiration of which a king's son shall come and awake her." The king, to avoid the misfortune foretold by the old fairy, caused immediately proclamations to be made, whereby everybody was forbidden, upon pain of death, to spin with a distaff and spindle, or to have so much as any spindle in their houses. About 15 or 16 years after, the king and queen being gone to one of their houses of pleasure, the young princess happened one day to divert herself running up and down the stairs of the palace. When going from one apartment to another, she came into a little room on the top of a tower, where a good old woman alone was spinning with her spindle. This good woman had never heard of the king's proclamation against spindles. "What are you doing there, goody?" said the princess. "I am spinning, my pretty child," said the old woman, who did not know who she was. "Ha!" said the princess. "This is very pretty. How do you do it? Give it to me, so I see if I can do so." She had no sooner taken the spindle in her hand than, whether being very hasty at it, somewhat unhandy, or that the decree of the fairy had so ordained it, it ran into her hand, and she fell down into a swoon. The good old woman, not knowing very well what to do in this affair, cried out for help. People came in from every quarter in great numbers. They threw water upon the princess's face, unlaced her, struck her on the palm of her hands, and rubbed her temples with hungry water, but nothing would bring her to herself. And now the king, who came up at the noise, bethought himself of the prediction of the fairies, and judging very well that this must necessarily come to pass, since the fairies had said it, caused the princess to be carried into the finest apartment in his palace, and to be laid upon a bed all embroidered with gold and silver. One would have taken her for an angel, she was so very beautiful, for her swooning away had not diminished one bit of her complexion. Her cheeks were carnation, and her lips like coral. Indeed, her eyes were shut, but she was heard to breathe softly, which satisfied those around her that she was not dead. The king commanded that they should not disturb her, but let her sleep quietly until her hour of awakening was come. The good fairy, who had saved her life by condemning her to sleep 100 years, was in the kingdom of Mataquin, 12,000 leagues off, when this accident befell the princess. But she was instantly informed of it by a little dwarf, who had boots of 7 leagues, that is, boots with which he could tread over 7 leagues of ground at one stride. The fairy came away immediately, and she arrived about an hour after in a fiery chariot drawn by dragons. The king handed her out of the chariot, and she approved everything he had done. But, as she had a very great foresight, she thought, when the princess should awake, she might not know what to do with herself, being all alone in this old palace. And this is what she did. She touched with her wand everything in the palace, except the king and queen. Governesses, maids of honor, ladies of the bedchamber, gentlemen, officers, stewards, cooks, undercooks, scullions, guards with their beef-eaters, pages, footmen. She likely touched all the horses which were in the stables, as well as their grooms, the great dogs in the outward court, and pretty little Mopsy, too, the princess's little spaniel bitch, which lay by her on the bed. Immediately upon her touching them, they all fell asleep, that they might not awake before their mistress, and that they might be ready to wait upon her when she wanted them. The very spits at the fire, as full as they could hold of partridges and pheasants, did fall asleep, and the fire likewise. All this was done in a moment. Fairies are not long at doing their business. And now the king and queen, having kissed their dear child without waking her, went out of the palace and put forth a proclamation that no one should dare come near it. This, however, was not necessary, for in a quarter of an hour's time there grew up, all around the park, such a vast number of trees, great and small, bushes and brambles, twining with one within another, that neither man nor beast could pass through, so that nothing could be seen but the very tops of the towers of the palace, and that, too, not unless it was a good way off. Nobody doubted but the fairy gave herein a sample of her art, that the princess, while she continued sleeping, might have nothing to fear from any curious people. When 100 years were gone and passed, the son of the king then reigning, and who was of another family from that of the sleeping princess, being gone a-hunting on that side of the country, asked, "What were those towers which he saw in the middle of a great thick wood?" Everyone answered according as they had heard. Some said that it was a ruinous old castle, haunted by spirits. Others, that all the sorcerers and the witches of the country kept their Sabbath, or night's meeting there. The common opinion was that an ogre lived there, and that he carried thither all the little children he could catch, that he might eat them up at his leisure, without anybody's being able to follow him, as having himself only the power to pass through the wood. The prince was at a stand, not knowing what to believe, when the very aged countryman spake to him thus, "May it please your royal highness, it is now above 50 years since I heard my father, who heard my grandfather, say that therein was in this castle a princess, the most beautiful as ever seen, that she must then sleep there 100 years, and should be awaked by a king's son, for whom she was reserved." Well, the young prince was all on fire at these words, believing, without a moment's doubt, that he could put an end to this rare adventure, and pushed on by love and honor, resolved that moment to look into it. Scarce had he advanced towards the wood, when all the great trees, the bushes and brambles, gave way of themselves to let him pass through. He walked up to the castle, which he saw at the end of a large avenue, which he went into, and what a little surprised him he was, that he saw none of his people could follow him, because the trees closed again as soon as he'd passed through them. However, he did not cease from continuing his way. A young and amorous prince is always valiant. He came into a spacious outward court, where everything he saw might have frozen up the most fearless person with horror. There reigned over all a most frightful silence. The image of death everywhere showed itself, and there was nothing to be seen but stretched out bodies of men and animals, all seeming to be dead. He, however, knew very well by the ruby faces and pimpled noses of the beef-eaters that they were only asleep, and their goblets, wherein still remained some drops of wine, showed plainly that they fell asleep in their cups. He then crossed a court paved with marble, went up the stairs, and came into the guard chamber, where the guards were standing in their ranks, with their muskets on their shoulders, and snoring as loud as they could. After that he went through several rooms full of gentlemen and ladies, all asleep, some standing, others sitting. At last he came into a chamber all gilded with gold, where he saw upon a bed, the curtains of which were all open, the finest sight was ever beheld. A princess, who appeared to be about 15 or 16 years of age, and whose bright and in a manner resplendent beauty had somewhat in it divine. He approached with trembling and admiration, and fell down before her on his knees. And now, as the enchantment was at an end, the princess awaked, and looking on him with eyes more tender than the first view might seem to admit of, "Is it you, my prince?" said she to him. "You have tarried long." The prince, charmed with these words, and much more with the manner in which they were spoken, knew not how to shew his joy and gratitude. He assured her that he loved her better than he did himself. His discourse was not well connected, but it pleased her all the more. Little eloquence, a great deal of love. He was more at a loss than she, and we need not wonder at it. She had some time to think on what to say to him, for it's very probable, though history mentions nothing of it, that the good fairy, during so long a sleep, had entertained her with pleasant dreams. In short, when they talked for hours together, they said not half what they had to say. In the meanwhile, all the palace awaked. Everyone thought upon their particular business, and as not all of them were not in love, they were ready to die for hunger. The chief lady of honor, being as sharp set as other folks, grew very impatient, and told the princes aloud that supper was served up. Prince helped the princess to rise. She was entirely dressed, and very magnificently, but His Royal Highness took care not to tell her that she was dressed like his great-grandmother, and had a point band peeping over a high collar, but she looked not the bit less beautiful and charming for all that. They went into the great hall looking-glasses, where they supped, and were served by the princess's officers. The violins and hautboys played old tunes, but very excellent, though it was now above 100 years since they'd been played. And after supper, without losing any time, the Lord Almoner married them in a chapel of the castle, and the chief lady of honor drew the curtains. They had but very little sleep. The prince had no occasion, and the prince left her the next morning to return into the city, where his father must needs have been anxious on his account. The prince told him that he lost his way in the forest as he was hunting, and that he had lain in the cottage of a collier, who gave him cheese and brown bread. The king, his father, who was of an easy disposition, believed him, but his mother could not be persuaded this was true, and seeing that he went almost every day hunting, and that he always had some excuse ready when he'd laid out 3 or 4 nights together, she no longer doubted he had some little amour, for he lived with the princess above 2 whole years, and had with her by 2 children, the eldest of which, who was a daughter, was named Aurora, and the youngest, who was a son, they called Day, because he was even handsomer and more beautiful than his sister. The queen said more than once to her son, in order to bring him to speak freely to her, that a young man must even take his pleasure, but he never dared to trust her with his secret. He feared her, though he loved her, for she was of the race of the ogres, and the king would have never married her, would have not for her vast riches. It was even whispered about the court that she had, you know, ogress inclinations, and whenever she saw little children passing by, she had all the difficulty in the world to refrain from falling upon them. And so the prince would never tell her one word about his new family. But when the king was dead, which happened about 2 years afterwards, and he saw himself lord and master, he openly declared his marriage, and he went in great ceremony to fetch his queen from the castle. They made a magnificent entry into the capital city, she riding between her 2 children. Sometime after, the king went to make war with the emperor Cantalabut. His neighbor. He left the government of the kingdom to the queen, his mother, and earnestly recommended to her care his wife and children. He was like to be at war all the summer, and as soon as he departed, the queen mother sent her daughter-in-law and her children to a country house among the woods, that she might with the more ease gratify her horrible longing. Some few days afterwards she went thither herself and said to the clerk of the kitchen, "I have a mind to eat little Aurora for my dinner tomorrow." "Oh, madam," cried the clerk of the kitchen.
"I will have it so," replied the queen. And this she spake in the tone of an ogress, which had a strong desire to eat fresh meat. "And I will eat her with the sauce, Robert."
The poor man, knowing very well that he must not play tricks with ogresses, took his great knife and went up to little Aurora's chamber. She was then 4 years old, and came up to him, jumping and laughing, to take him about the neck and ask him for some sugar candy, upon which he began to weep. The great knife fell out of his hand, and he went into the backyard and killed a little lamb, and dressed it with such good sauce that his mistress assured him she'd never eaten anything so good in all her life. He had at the same time taken up little Aurora and carried her to his wife to conceal her in the lodging he had at the end of the courtyard. About 8 days afterward, the wicked queen said to the clerk of the kitchen, "I will sup upon little Day." He answered not a word, being resolved to again cheat her as he had done before. He went to find out little Day, and saw him with a little foil in his hand, with which he was fencing with a great monkey, the child being only then 3 years of age. He took him up in his arms and carried him to his wife, that she might conceal him in her chamber along with his sister. And in the room of little Day cooked up a young kid, very tender, which the ogress found to be wonderfully good. This was hitherto all mighty well, but one evening this wicked queen said to her clerk of the kitchen, "I will eat the queen, Aurora, with the same sauce I had with her children." It was now that the poor clerk of the kitchen despaired of being able to deceive her. The young queen was turned of 20, not reckoning the 100 years she'd been asleep. Her skin was somewhat tough, though very fair and white, and how to find in the yard a beast so firm was what puzzled him. He took then a resolution that he might save his own life to cut the queen's throat, and going up in her chamber with intent to do it at once, he put himself into as great a fury as he possibly could, and came into the young queen's room with his dagger in his hand. He would not, however, surprise her, but told her with a great deal of respect the orders he had received from the queen mother. "Do it, do it," said she, stretching out her neck. "Execute your orders, and then I shall go and see my children, my poor children, whom I so much and so tenderly loved." For she thought them dead ever since they'd been taken away without her knowledge. "No, no, madam," cried the poor clerk of the kitchen, all in tears. "You shall not die, and yet you shall see your children again, but it must be in my lodgings, where I have concealed them, and I shall deceive the queen once more, by giving her in your stead a young hind." Upon this he forthwith conducted her to his chamber, where, leaving her to embrace her children and cry along with them, he went and dressed a hind, which the queen had for her supper, and devoured it with the same appetite as if it had been the young queen. Exceedingly was she delighted with her cruelty, and she had invented a story to tell the king at his return how ravenous wolves had eaten up Queen Aurora and her two children. One evening, as she was, according to her custom, rambling about the courts and yards of the palace to see if she could smell any fresh meat, she heard in a ground room little Day crying, for his mamma was going to whip him because he had been naughty, and she heard at the same time little Aurora begging pardon for her brother. The ogress presently knew the voice of the queen and her children, and being quite mad that she'd been thus deceived, she commanded next morning by break of day, with a most horrible voice which made everybody tremble, that they should bring into the middle of the great court a large tub, which she caused to be filled with toads, vipers, snakes, and all sorts of serpents, in order to have thrown into it the queen and her children, the clerk of the kitchen, his wife, and her maid, all of which she had given orders to bring thither with their hands tied behind them. They were brought out accordingly, and the executioners were just going to throw them into the tub, when the king, who was not so soon expected, entered the court on horseback, for he came post,
and asked with the utmost astonishment what was the meaning of that horrible spectacle. No one dared to tell him, when the ogress, all enraged to see what had happened, threw herself head foremost into the tub and was instantly devoured by the ugly creature she'd ordered to be thrown in for others. The king could not but be very sorry, for she was his mother. But he soon comforted himself with his beautiful wife and his pretty children. The end. Great googly moogly. And from that portrait of motherhood and sleep and dreams and motherhood, back to Suspiria. Great googly moogly. Anyway, one thing I noticed upon my second viewing of the remake of Suspiria is that Rain is an actual character in the Suspiria remake, which is so fitting because one of the most iconic scenes in the original is Susie Banyan's arrival at the dance school. The 1977, yes, the remake is set in the year the original was shot, version opens in the pouring rain as Susie arrives in a taxi to see another dancer leaving the school and screaming at an unseen person inside that she is leaving because the instructors are witches. But Susie cannot hear what this girl is yelling due to the incessant violent rain, which is pounding along with Goblin's unforgettable, unnerving soundtrack. And so Susie enters the school. I noticed upon the second viewing of the remake that it rained incessantly until Susie started claiming her personal power, and that it rained during extremely important scenes, and then the rain stopped, never to return, slowly replaced with snow, and that it was snowing hard when Dr. Klemperer was tricked and lured back to the Marco School of Dance. The rain is loud and invasive. You can hear it inside your residence. Rain soaks your hair, clothing, skin, belongings. Rain can flood. It pounds and rattles and distracts, and it demands to be heard. Snow is soft and insidious and quiet. One can sleep through a night of snow to awaken to a surprise blizzard, to a surprise blanket of white, to a surprise change landscape. Rain is violent change. Rain is fear. Rain is tempest. Snow is sneakiness. Snow is also softness. Snow can be playful, and snow can smother. The Volk dance of stomps and slamps and grunts and loud breaths is pounding rain. Susie's commanding presence at the Black Sabbath is snow. Which leads us back in a circle to Snow White, one of the sources that inspired the original writer and director, Dario Argento. And today I'm going to read another fairy tale, a translation of the very first edition of Little Snow White. And it's quite different. I want to compare it to the version I read in episode 51, Elegant Nastiness, which is a version of unknown date. It's also by the Grimm Brothers, and it's a version I got from Gutenberg.org. The version I'm going to read today is a brand new translation of the very first edition. It's a translation done by Jack Zipes. The source is in the show notes, and it'll be on the website entry for this episode. But it is the very first edition. There are several really interesting differences between the version I read in episode 51 and the first edition I'm going to read today. In the version from episode 51, the Evil Queen is the stepmother of Snow White. More interestingly, for Suspiria and the Three Mothers series, the first edition's Evil Vain Queen is actually Little Snow White's mother. Again, in the original version, in both versions, Snow White is 7 years old. Did you notice that? From episode 51, she's 7. So one, her stepmother slash mother is competing with her 7-year-old stepdaughter slash daughter with regards to beauty, from which we are to assume the ability to track men, to be sexually alluring. 7. This is the disturbing landscape of fairy tales that we do sometimes do not notice that's underneath the surface. That's the oogie stuff under the moss-covered rock when you turn it over.
7 years old is, in some cultures and religions, considered to be the age of reason, the age at which children can be considered to have moral responsibility for their actions. So it's interesting to me that she's specifically 7 years old. Maybe a coincidence? Maybe. But you know me. I love relishing all the details, and I don't truly believe in coincidences. Everything's related. I'm going to John Nash this shit. And the first edition translation I'm going to read today, the mirror speech, the mirror, mirror speech from the Queen, is translated differently, is the more familiar version to us English speakers. It's the version that the Disney movie used, you know, the mirror, mirror on the wall, rather than the different, more awkward version, I guess that's a good word, and from the version I read in episode 51. In this first edition, there's the same strange worship of the dead or nearly dead as echoed in the three dancers in the Suspiria remake. Only it's much more intense in this version than in the translation I read in episode 51. Much more intense. Also, what disturbs me far more than Snow White's age is the intensity in this version of the dwarves and the prince's struggle for Snow White's corpse. They all want desperately to keep in house her body. Why? Why? For what purpose? It's never overtly stated. But a man of high standing comes across an apparently dead child and his daily travels just do 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 do. Oh, look. And he must have her at all costs. And those that do have her must keep her. Their purpose being not love, nor grief, nor the sanctity of the dead, but just because they too wish to continue to gaze upon her? Eerie implications indeed. One of the reasons I love fairy tales and folk tales is this insidiousness and, yes, quote unquote, exquisite mayhem. Of course, the theme of repeated temptation in Little Snow White relates back to Suspiria. Again, we hear echoes of Patricia telling her psychiatrist that at first she liked it. The gifts, the perfect balance and perfect sleep. We see those in the witches. Pretty corset stay ties and the pretty combs that she offers Snow White. Also, keeping the family name alive in this first edition translation, it's clearly stated that the dwarves are brothers and there's much celebration when little Snow White is returned to her family after being kept alive like Mother Marcos. And in this edition translation, I was delighted to find at this family reunion and wedding celebration, the evil queen is punished by being forced to dance in iron dancing shoes and dance to death. Danced! She's danced for punishment, much like the psychotic dance in the Black Sabbath dance in the finale of the Suspiria remake, and the Volk dance, which is obviously a ritual. She's danced to death as a punishment to force to dance in iron dancing shoes. I'm such a geek, I'm sorry. I had a real moment when I read this version. And because it's my podcast, you're going to have moments with me. So, without further geeky ado, here is the first edition of the Brothers Grimm short story, Little Snow White. Newly translated by Zach Sipes. Jack Sipes. There's link to the source. I cannot talk today. There is a link to the source text in the show notes and the website entry for this episode coming up. And I apologize, there will be actual page turn sounds with this. Once upon a time, in the middle of winter, when snowflakes were falling like feathers from the sky, a beautiful queen was sitting and sewing at a window with a black ebony frame. And as she was sewing and looking out the window at the snow, she pricked her finger with the needle, and three drops of blood fell on the snow. The red looked so beautiful on the white snow that she thought to herself, "If only I had a child as white as snow, as red as blood, and as black as the wood of the window frame." Soon thereafter, she gave birth to a little daughter who was white as snow, as red as blood, and her hair as black as ebony. And that's why the child was called Little Snow White. The queen was the most beautiful woman in the entire land, and very proud about her beauty. She also had a mirror, and every morning she stepped in front of it and said, "Mirror, mirror, on the wall, who in this land is fairest of them all?" The mirror would answer, "You, my queen, are fairest of them all." And then she knew for certain that there was nobody more beautiful in the entire world. However, little Snow White grew up, and when she was 7 years old, she was so beautiful that her beauty surpassed even that of the queen, her mother. And when the queen asked her mirror, "Mirror, mirror, on the wall, who in this land is fairest of them all?" the mirror answered, "You, my queen, may have a beauty quite rare, but little Snow White is 1,000 times more fair." When the queen heard the mirror speak this way, she became pale with envy, and from that hour onward, she hated Snow White. And when she looked at her and thought that little Snow White was to blame that she, the queen, was no longer the most beautiful woman in the world, her heart turned against little Snow White. Her jealousy kept upsetting her, and so she summoned the huntsman and said, "Take the child out into the forest to a spot far from here. Then stab her to death and bring back her lungs and her liver as proof of your deed. After that, I'll cook them with salt and eat them." The huntsman took little Snow White and led her out into the forest. But when he drew his large hunting knife and was about to stab her, she began to weep and pleaded so much to let her live and promised never to return but to run deeper into the forest. The huntsman was moved to pity, also because she was so beautiful. Anyway, he thought the wild beasts in the forest would soon devour her.
"I'm glad that I won't have to kill her."
Just then a young boar came dashing by, and the huntsman stabbed it to death. He took out the lungs and the liver and brought them to the queen as proof that the child was dead. Then she boiled them in salt, ate them, and thought that she had eaten little Snow White's lungs and liver. Meanwhile, little Snow White was so all alone in the huge forest that she became afraid and began to run and run over sharp stones and through thorn bushes. She ran the entire day. Finally, as the sun was about to set, she came upon a little cottage that belonged to 7 dwarfs. However, they were not at home but had gone to the mines. When little Snow White entered, she found everything tiny, but dainty and neat. There was a little table with a white tablecloth, and on it were 7 little plates with 7 tiny spoons, 7 tiny knives and tiny forks, and 7 tiny cups. In a row against the wall stood 7 little beds recently covered with sheets. Since she was so hungry and thirsty, little Snow White ate some vegetables and bread from each of the little plates and had a drop of wine to drink out of each one of the tiny cups. And since she was so tired, she wanted to lay down and sleep. So she began trying out the beds, but none of them suited her until she found that the 7th one was just right. So she laid down on it and fell asleep. When it turned to night, the 7 dwarfs returned home from their work and lit their 7 little candles. Then they saw that someone had been in their house. The 1st dwarf said, "Who's been sitting in my chair?" "Who's eaten off my plate?" said the 2nd. "Who's eaten some of my bread?" said the 3rd. "Who's eaten some of my vegetables?" said the 4th. "Who's been using my little fork?" said the 5th. "Who's been cutting with my little knife?" said the 6th. "Who's had something to drink from my little cup?" said the 7th. Then the 1st dwarf looked around and said, "Who's been sleeping in my bed?" Then the 2nd one cried out, "Someone's been sleeping in my bed." And he was followed by each one of them until the 7th dwarf looked at his bed and saw little Snow White lying there asleep. The others came running over to him, and they were so astounded that they screamed and fetched their 7 little candles to observe little Snow White. "Oh, my lord, oh, my lord," they exclaimed. "How beautiful she is." They took great delight in her, but they didn't wake her up. Instead, they let her sleep in the bed, while the 7th dwarf slept an hour in each of his companion's bed until the night had passed. When little Snow White awoke, they asked her who she was and how she'd managed to come to their cottage. Then she told them how her mother had wanted to have her killed, how the huntsman had spared her life, and how she had run all day until she had eventually arrived at their cottage. Then the dwarfs took pity on her and said, "If you'll keep house for us, cook, sew, make the beds, wash, and knit, and if you'll keep everything neat and orderly, you can stay with us, and we'll provide you with everything you need. When we come home in the evening, dinner must be ready. During the day, we're in the mines and we dig for gold. You'll be alone, and you'll have to watch out for the queen and not let anyone enter the cottage. In the meantime, the queen believed that she was once again the most beautiful woman in the land, and she stepped before her mirror and asked, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who in this land is fairest of them all?" The mirror answered, "You, my queen, may have a beauty most rare, but beyond the seven mountains, this I must tell, little Snow White is living quite well. Indeed, she's still a thousand times more fair." When the queen heard this, she was horrified, for she saw that she had been deceived and that the huntsman had not killed little Snow White. Since nobody but the seven dwarves lived in the seven mountains region, the queen knew immediately that little Snow White was dwelling with them and began once again plotting ways to kill her. As long as the mirror refused to say that she was the most beautiful woman in the land, she would remain upset. Since she couldn't be absolutely certain and didn't trust anyone, she disguised herself as an old peddler woman, painted her face so no one could recognize her, and went to the cottage of the seven dwarfs, where she knocked at the door and cried out, "Open up, open up. I'm the old peddler woman. I've got pretty wares for sale." Little Snow White looked out the window. "What do you have for sale?" "Stay laces, dear child," the old woman replied, and took out a lace woven from yellow, red, and blue silk. "Do you want it?" "Well, yes," said little Snow White, and thought, "I can certainly let this good old woman inside. She's honest enough." So little Snow White unbolted the door and bought the lace. "My goodness, you're so sloppily laced up," said the old woman. "Come, I'll lace you up properly for once." Little Snow White stood obediently in front of the old woman, who took the lace and tied it around little Snow White so tightly that she lost her breath and fell down as if dead. Then the queen was satisfied and left. Not long after nightfall, the dwarves came home, and when they saw their dear Snow White lying on the ground, they were horrified, for she seemed to be dead. They lifted her up, and when they saw that she was laced too tightly, they cut the stay lace in two. At once she began to breathe a little, and after a while she had fully revived. "That was nobody else but the queen," they said. "She wanted to take your life. Be careful, and don't let anyone else enter the cottage." Now the queen asked her mirror, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who in this land is fairest of all?" The mirror answered, "You, my queen, may have a beauty quite rare, but little Snow White's alive. This I must tell. She's with the dwarves and doing quite well. Indeed, she's still a thousand times more fair." The queen was so horrified that all the blood rushed to her heart when she realized that little Snow White was alive once again. So she began thinking day and night how she could put an end to little Snow White. Finally, she made a poisoned hair comb, disguised herself in a completely different shape, and went off to the dwarves' cottage once again. When she knocked on the door, however, little Snow White called out, "I'm not allowed to let anyone enter." The queen took out the comb, and when little Snow White saw it shine and that the woman was someone completely different from the one she had previously met, she opened the door and bought the comb. "Come," said the peddler woman, "I'll also comb your hair." But no sooner did the old woman stick the comb in little Snow White's hair than the little maiden fell down and was dead. "Now you'll remain lying there," said the queen, and her heart had become lighter as she returned home. However, the dwarves came home in the nick of time. When they saw what had happened, they pulled the poison comb out of little Snow White's hair, and she opened her eyes and was alive again. She again promised the dwarves that she would certainly not let anyone inside ever again. Now the queen stepped in front of her mirror once more and asked, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who in this land is fairest of all?" The mirror answered, "You, my queen, may have a beauty quite rare, but little Snow White's alive, this I must tell. She's with the dwarves and doing quite well. Indeed, she's still a thousand times more fair." When the queen heard this once again, she trembled and shook with rage. "Little Snow White shall die," she exclaimed, "even if it costs me my own life." Then she went to a secret chamber where no one was allowed to enter.
Once inside, she made a deadly poisonous apple. On the outside, it looked beautiful with red cheeks. Anyone who saw it would be enticed to take a bite. And thereafter, she disguised herself as a peasant woman, went to the dwarf's cottage, and knocked on the door. Little Snow White looked and said, "I'm not allowed to let anyone inside. The seven dwarfs have strictly forbidden me."
"Well, if you don't want to let me in, I can't force you," answered the peasant woman. "I'll surely get rid of my apples in time, but let me give you one to test."
"No," called Little Snow White. "I'm not allowed to take anything. The dwarfs won't let me."
"You're probably afraid," said the old woman. "Look, I'll cut you an apple in two. You can eat the beautiful red half." However, the apple had been made with such cunning that only the red part was poisoned. When Little Snow White saw through the window that the peasant woman was eating her half, and when her desire to taste the apple grew stronger, she finally let the peasant woman give her the other half through the window. As soon as she took the bite of the apple, she fell to the ground and was dead. The queen rejoiced, went home, and asked the mirror, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who in this land is the fairest of all?" And the mirror answered, "You, my queen, are now the fairest of all." "Now I can rest in peace," she said. "Once again, I am the most beautiful in the land, and Snow White will remain dead this time." When the dwarves came home from the mines that evening, they found little Snow White lying on the ground, and she was dead. They unlaced her, and they tried to find something poisonous in her hair, but nothing helped. They couldn't revive her, so they laid her on a bier, and all seven of them sat down beside it and wept for 3 whole days. Then they attended to bury her, but she looked more alive than dead, and she still had such pretty red cheeks. So instead they made a glass coffin and placed her inside so she could easily be seen. Then they wrote her name on the coffin in gold letters, and they added the family name. One of the dwarves remained at home every day to keep watch over her. So little Snow White laid in the coffin for a long, long time, but did not rot. She was still white as snow and red as blood, but if her eyes could have opened, they would have been black as ebony. Because she was sleeping. Now it happened that a prince came to the dwarf's cottage one day and wanted to spend the night there. When he entered the room, and he saw little Snow White lying in the coffin and the seven little candles casting their light right on her, he couldn't get enough of her beauty. Then he read the golden inscription, and he saw that she was a princess. So he asked the dwarfs to sell him the coffin with the dead little Snow White inside. But they wouldn't accept all the gold in the world for it. Then he pleaded with them to give little Snow White to him as a gift, because he couldn't live without gazing upon her, and he would honor her and hold her in high regard as his most beloved in the world all of his days. Well, the dwarfs took pity on him and gave him the coffin, and the prince had it carried to his castle. It was then placed in his room, where he himself sat the entire day and couldn't take his eyes off her. And when he had to leave the room and couldn't see little Snow White, he became sad. Indeed, he couldn't eat a thing unless he was standing near the coffin. However, the servants, who had to carry the coffin from place to place in the castle all the time, became angry about this. And at one time, a servant opened the coffin, lifted the dead little Snow White in the air, and said, "Why must we be plagued with so much work, all because of a dead maiden?" On saying this, he shoved little Snow White's back with his hand, and out popped the nasty piece of apple that had been stuck in little Snow White's throat, and she was once again alive. As soon as this happened, she went to the prince, and when he saw his dear little Snow White alive, he rejoiced so much that he didn't know what to do. Then they sat down at the dinner table and ate with delight. The wedding was planned for the next day, and Snow White's godless mother was also invited to attend.
I have to stop her here. I'm not adding that in. It says Snow White's godless mother, just so you know. So anyway, back to the story.
The wedding was planned for the next day, and Snow White's godless mother was also invited to attend. When she now stepped before the mirror, she said, "Mirror, mirror on the wall, who in this land is the fairest of all?" And the mirror replied, "You, my queen, may have a beauty quite rare, but little Snow White is 1,000 times more fair." When she heard this, she was horrified, and became so afraid, so very afraid, that she didn't know what to do. However, her jealousy drove her so much that she wanted to be seen at the wedding. When she arrived, she saw that little Snow White was the bride. Iron slippers were then heated over a fire. The queen had to put them on and dance in them, and her feet were miserably burned, but she had to keep dancing in them until she danced herself to death. I hope you've enjoyed the second deep dive into the Three Mothers horror movie series as much as I have. There will be, as I've said, appropriately enough in several ways, a third episode. So many triads. For next time, architecture and geography as spell work, the role of Jung in identity and witchcraft and in these movies, and the role of the triad, not only Maid, Mother, and Crone, but also the other triads mentioned briefly in Mother of Tears, the Furies, the Fates, and the Graces, and the original source inspiration for the original Suspiria, Thomas De Quincey. Thank you, as always, for listening. I love you guys. Thanks to my new physical therapy regimen and certain plans I've put into place behind the scenes, I plan to be recording for you much more often. Please stay tuned in just a second for a promo for my friend Kat Morris's new podcast, Active. It's a brand new, exciting true crime podcast I'm really psyched about. It's a well-sourced and thoughtful deep dive into active shooters. Why do people shoot in public?
The investigation into the high school massacre
is... Parkland High School Massacre.
At least 14 dead, 50 injured.
13 people were killed today in a mass shooting that includes a suspected gunman.
Coming soon, Active Shooter, a podcast that studies the psychology, motives, and methods behind some of the most notorious active shooters in North America and beyond.
They're saying somebody's shooting in the auditorium. 315 and 314.
We will discuss the whys, the hows, and most importantly, the proposed solutions.
316 men to rescue in here, hot. You got a guy shot.
Can the proper mix of mental health services and gun access put a stop to what has now become an accepted everyday occurrence? Have we become desensitized and accepting of this new phenomenon? Join us as we break down each case and discuss the failures that led to each event and how we can identify and stop them in the future. Join us soon, and please subscribe to Active Shooter.